morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive and the deadly myths that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to look behind the headlines and understand what is actually occurring while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we will continue to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone credible voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Anytime over the next 2 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, our number is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Yes, there's been so many wonderful statements about Christian Mingle being able to perform great miracles and being God's instrument in our world. Of course, God was incapable of delivering results on his own, so he is, I'm sure, quite grateful that Christian Mingle came up with this computer program so he could manipulate free will. But this commercial actually said that the child was born, they had a family because of God's involvement with Christian Mingle. I'm quite certain that is not the way it works.
Find God's match for you the way we did.
Join today.
That's just stupid.
Thank you for the commentary. I agree wholeheartedly. Speaking of stupid, we have the first item of news is something that we were covering at the end of our program on Friday. I'd like to continue with it. We found that one of the six wives, which is, by the way, inconsistent with Islam, you're allowed to have four wives. Now, you can have more than four in actuality, but only if the fourth is a rotating spot. That's the reason that Muslims can go to brothels and the like. That's the reason that Muslims can rape little girls on the street and I guess rape little boys as well, is that the fourth position rotates. It can be a temporary wife. Well, this fellow, who is Assad, so directly related to the thugs that control the fiefdom of Saudi Arabia, which is the principal wellspring from which Islamic terrorism flows. They build more mosques and hire more imams than any other country in the world. We keep in mind that about 80% of the 9/11 suicide bombers were Saudis. A Saudi princess, they consider themselves royalty, and the beginning of all this, by the way, was that there was a warlord, Assad, in Saudi Arabia, that decided that if he formed a union with a firebrand Islamic cleric, Wahhab, that the Saab-Wahhab connection would make for some very effective Mujahideen fighters, and that with the collection of fighters, the warlord and the cleric collectively could get Great Britain in the midst of World War I to give them lots of money and to promise them their own personal fiefdom should they successfully fight against the Ottoman Turks, who were also Muslims. When the British Empire, particularly once the United States entered World War I, prevailed, and the Turks lost, and they lost largely because of the fact that they tried to go to war against Russia with Allah's help, and Allah got his behind kicked. It's when the defeated Ottoman Turks came back through eastern Turkey on their way home, bedraggled, that Allah didn't give them victory, and decided that, you know, what would be fun now is to assuage our anger by killing 1.5 to 2 million Turkish Assyrian Christians, and that was the genocide that caused all of that. Well, in the midst of all of this, the British government decided that they would give the Saud warlord and his Wahhab cleric their own personal country, their own fiefdom, where they could pretend to be kings. And that is why this princess was now stunningly rich, because almost immediately after that award, we found Americans and Brits discovered oil. oil beneath the sands of Saudi Arabia. We built the infrastructure to extract it, and we built the infrastructure to transport it. We built the infrastructure to get it to large ships. We built the large ships, and then the Sauds confiscated all of that and then formed a monopoly called OPEC. So they're now fabulously wealthy thugs. Well, a princess, a wife of one of the Sauds, was in Orange County. And there, one of her maids decided that she didn't like being abused anymore. She had received, when she was in Saudi Arabia, in the embassy where she had to get an American visa to travel into this country, she had picked up a pamphlet that said that you have rights when you enter America, that if you are being abused, you have the right to asylum in America. So when it was found that the Saudi princess was abusing her domestic workers, they were shocked in Orange County, because we're told it's the melting pot of many cultures, which means that the little princes and princesses in Orange County hadn't bothered to read a newspaper, and they were unaware that most countries had actually passed laws that make it illegal for Saudi Arabia to find domestic workers in their country, because so many of them are murdered, so many of them are raped, so many of them are tortured, that that of the million paid workers in Saudi Arabia, because the Saudi Arabians themselves don't work, they bribe other people to work, and then they abuse them. Most countries have forbidden their citizens to even go there. The abuse is so rampant. Well, the people who are hired, this is from a expert on the this man's name is Claude Arnold, a special agent in charge of Homeland Security investigations in Los Angeles, said the people who are hired as such think that they're getting a benefit from it. They're getting a roof over their head. They're getting fed, said Claude Arnold, the Homeland Security investigations chief. On the face of it, they think they're getting treated well, so they don't think of themselves as victims, no matter how much they are abused. Khalid Abu El Fadel, a professor of Islamic law at UCLA, this would be a professor of Sharia law at UCLA, said servants are treated so poorly and for so long that they become completely docile. The Saudi employer cannot imagine them as anyone who has free will. So they comfortably view them as part of the baggage, and they bring them to the United States and Europe. Sometimes, however, servants use these trips as their chance to escape. There have been warnings from the Saudi government to wealthy people, the Saudi government is just an extension of the Saud household, to wealthy people, which is an extension of the Saud household, not to bring their domestic servants when they travel to the U.S. or Europe for precisely this reason. Yes, they don't have warnings to say, you know, you ought not abuse people, you ought not enslave people, you ought not cheat and torture people, but they do have warnings that, you know, if you go to a country like the United States or Europe, where they have laws against enslaving people, about abusing people, about torturing people, you might get in trouble. And I tell you this story because it's important to know that the wellspring of Islam, the ground zero for Islam, the country that is the fiefdom, I should say, that has control of not only Mecca but Medina, the birthplace of Islam, that the rulers in that country are savages. They are absolute savages, and no amount of money from the black ooze that flows underneath their sands is sufficient to make these savages anything more than absolute, dreadful, and disgusting barbarians. In the in March 2012, Aliban, one of six wives of Prince Abdul Rahman bin Nasser bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, the Al Saud means that that her husband was a member of the ruling family Al Saud. That's why it is Saudi Arabia. Abdul Rahman means a slave to Al Rahman, which was the first god of the Quran. Hired the servant through a Kenyan employment agency, authorities said. The woman, 30, said that she needed money to provide medical care for her 7-year-old daughter, who still remains in Kenya. So the woman accepted the job to provide medical care for her 7-year-old daughter. Her contract said that she would work 5 days a week for 8 hours a day, and that she would be paid $1,600 a month. After 3 months, she could return home if she was not happy, according to the contract. But once she arrived in Saudi Arabia, the most barbarian of countries, authorities said the princess tore up the contract. She confiscated the woman's passport, and she refused to return it. She was forced to work 7 days a week for 16 hours a day, and she was paid a measly $220 a month. She was enslaved. These are the sods that Americans wallow all over. These are the sods that George W. Bush invited to his ranch. These are the sods that Americans sacrifice their coin and their blood to keep in power so that and push Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait so that he wouldn't next topple Saudi Arabia. These are the people that America enriches because this country doesn't have the good sense to develop its own energy reserves. This is the country that America considers its ally. If your allies are this revolting, this is the Saud family. This is not some estranged individual out there. This is the Saud family. This is the country. When your allies are this perverted, it says something extraordinarily bad about your own character. The woman, of course, was part of a vast domestic workforce. Antoinette Villiger, a law professor at the University of Amsterdam, who has written extensively about the lives of domestic employees in Saudi Arabia, said the country employs more than 1 million maids from developing countries. Even if they get raped when they go to the police to report that, there are most cases where the police simply rape them again. It is a country of savages for savages. We ought not partner with them. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yenna. The conclusion of this story is that the princess was arrested, but she was given the opportunity to post $5 million bail, which for a sod is like you and I giving a $5 tip to a valet, and that was it. So we'll see. My guess is that she will never participate in any of the trial proceedings. No, the U.S. government will come to her rescue because she is a sod. This report from Reuters, the United States and Pakistan agreed on Thursday to reestablish a full partnership. Now, this is the country where, well, while Saudi Arabia is the fuel for Islamic terrorism. They fund it. They provide the mosques and the imams who motivate Islamic terrorists. The largest state sponsor of terrorism by far is Pakistan in terms of actually sponsoring the organizations which commit the acts. And now, there's a direct link between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Saudi Arabia funds Pakistan for a number of reasons, but Pakistan is the wellspring from which terrorist organizations are developed, orchestrated, and managed, while Saudi Arabia provides the fuel upon which they run. So the United States decided it's going to have a full partnership with Pakistan again, hoping to end years of acrimony over U.S. drone strikes on Pakistan soil and the raid that killed Osama bin Laden and other grievances. We're here to speak honestly with each other, the Secretary of State John Kerry said, which means as a politician, I'm here to lie to you, you're here to lie to me, and most importantly, we're here to lie to our citizens. Openly about any gaps that may exist that we may want to try to bridge. Open gaps. The fact that the Taliban is an agency of the Pakistani government, and in one country we're providing them with weapons, and in another country we're trying to kill them, you might say that that might be a gap. That Osama bin Laden was in a what is considered a beautiful home for by Pakistani standards, about 200 yards from their version of West Point, where all of their military cadets are trained, and that they were opposed to the United States going after him. Maybe that is a little bit of a gap. The fact that the ISI provides intelligence to Islamic jihadists and trains Islamic jihadists that kill Americans might be a gap that they may want to try to bridge. Mr. Kerry then said, our people deserve that we talk directly. Why? Why do we, just like we're funding and align with enriching the barbarians that control Saudi Arabia, why don't you tell me why our people, why the American people deserve that we form alliances with Pakistan? Are we so decadent? Are we so corrupt? Are we so grotesquely immoral? Are we so stupid that we deserve our government forming treaties and bribing and lying to us and providing weapons to Pakistan? Don't blame us, Secretary of State John Kerry. Blame yourself. Blame the administration. Blame the U.S. government, but don't blame our people. Besides the killing of bin Laden in Pakistan by U.S. Navy SEALs, which was, by the way, a terrible breach of the United States moral code. We should have brought him back for trial, but the government of the United States doesn't want Islamic terrorists tried because they're concerned that Americans might understand that al-Qaeda is meaningless. It has always been meaningless. The problem is Islam, it is not al-Qaeda, and the trial would have proven that, so that's the reason Osama bin Laden was killed as opposed to brought back for trial, and Americans didn't seem to care that there was no due process, that we have every right just to go off and kill anybody that does not like us. But what they don't process is, if the United States has the authority under this misconception that we're in war against terrorists, that we can go off and kill any terrorist we want to anywhere in the world without a due process, then it empowers them to be able, under the standard rules of international law and acts of war, to go kill Americans anytime they want to. You know, if we have the right to kill them because we don't like them, then that gives them the right to kill us because they do not like us. When you engage in this kind of war where killing is without due process, then you empower the other side, which is something Americans don't want to think about. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. This is an amazing story. It really tells you just how disgusting our society is, how far we have fallen in terms of no longer being able to reason, no longer being able to think, that all that matters now in our society is promoting agendas. This story was appeared under the banner of the BBC this morning. I'll share bits of it and comment along the way. It begins, one of the bombers suspected of carrying out the Boston bombings was in possession of right-wing American literature in the run-up to the attack, the BBC Panorama has learned. So the BBC has I don't know if you call it a group, but it has a show. Well, let's say that the BBC has a show. It has a group of showmen that are part of Panorama. It sounds like the robot or the Rainbow Coalition here, Panorama. And what Panorama was able to find. Now, we can't get a copy of Joe Carr's confession letter where he said, I did this all in the name of Allah, and that Tamerlane is already enjoying the virgins in paradise as a result of being a jihadist, that all of the Islamic associations with these boys have not been released. But Panorama, wanting to paint a different picture, the picture the government wants to paint, which is of right-wing extremism, so that they can have America think that the enemy are right-wing extremists, was given access to information that says that they had in their possession right-wing American literature. Now, they don't have anything that says that they were motivated by these things, only that they were examining them. So, here we go. Tamerlane Shanarev subscribed to publications espousing white supremacy and government conspiracy theories. He also had reading material on mass killings. Now, they don't say that he was surrounded by Qurans, by collections of hadith, and that he spent most of his time studying Islam and going to Islamic websites, but no, he had subscribed to publications espousing white supremacy and government conspiracy theories. Until now, the Panorama agency of the BBC says, until now, the Shanarev brothers were widely perceived as just self-styled radical jihadists. Ah, now, but we want to paint them as right-wing extremists because that is better for those who wish to control the lives of their people. So, from now on, we have to look at them not as self-styled radical jihadists. Now, by the way, they forgot to mention Islam in there. And just perceptions as opposed to outright knowledge. No, now they can't be looked at that way. They have to be looked at as right-wing radicals. Panorama has spent months speaking exclusively with friends. Oh, boy. So no one else is speaking to anyone, just Panorama, of the bombers to try to understand the roots of their radicalization. Go read a Quran. Go read the Hadith, and you will understand not their radicalization, their fundamentalist Islamic nature. The program discovered that Tamerlane Shanarev possessed articles which argued that both 9/11 and the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings were government conspiracies. Guess what? There is a tie-in there. 9/11 was an Islamic attack on Islamic suicide bombing on the trade centers. It was orchestrated by Ramzi Youssef, who came up with the plan. Ramzi Youssef was also the individual who orchestrated the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings. The training on building the bomb and the funding and all of the efforts to get that bombing completed were done in the Philippines with Ramzi Youssef, just as was the 9/11 bombings. So, if you're an Islamic terrorist and you want to make a big splash, whose bombings are you going to study? Yeah, 9/11 and 1995 Oklahoma City. Another in his possession was about the rape of our gun rights. Well, these boys wanted to have guns. Muslims love to kill. Killing is germane to Islam. And so having guns is part of their strategy. They were armed, after all. Reading material he had about white supremacy commented that Hitler had a point. What was Hitler's point? He wanted to blame Jews for everything. What do Muslims want to do? to blame Jews for everything. These morons working for the BBC don't understand any of these connections. No, what they want to do, they're not investigating. They don't want anyone to consider the preponderance of the evidence, which is Islam, or the Islamic connection to any of these articles. But they just want to talk about these articles for what purpose? To mislead. Tamerlane Shanaref also had literature which explored what motivated mass killings and noted how perpetrators murdered and maimed and remained calm. All part of his plan to kill in the name of his God, Allah. There was also material about U.S. drones killing civilians, about the plight of those still imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. What kind of civilians are the U.S. drones killing? What kind of individuals are imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay, dear BBC? Can't you say it? Muslims. The Shanaref brothers, ethnic Chechnyans, which is irrelevant. They were Muslims, spent their early years moving around the troubled region of Russia torn by violence. Oh, and we have now Islamic insurgency. We're going to mention Islam and Islamic insurgency only in connection with them being ethnic Chechnyans. But for the last decade, oh, see, we have a contrast now, but for the next last decade, they lived in Cambridge near Boston. Oh, so we must separate them from the Islamic insurgencies. The brothers' friends told us that Tamerlane turned against the country and became passionate about Islam only after becoming frustrated when his boxing career faltered because he did not have American citizenship. Well, he didn't have American citizenship because of two reasons. One is that he was beating his girlfriends, and number two, because of his Islamic fundamentalist leanings. Their friends wouldn't speak at all openly because they were afraid of being wrongly viewed as being associated with terrorism. Oh, this was perfect for the BBC. So the BBC could report anything they wanted to report because there would be no witnesses. A person named Mike spent a lot of time with the brothers at their flat. Just Mike. He, Tamerlane, just didn't like America. He felt like America was basically attacking all Middle Eastern countries. Well, Mike, what is the common thread between all Middle Eastern countries save one? Islam. You know, trying to take their oil. Oh, of course, yes. That's what the United States is doing. You really have to be an idiot, Muslim, to think that that is what the United States is doing, is trying to steal Islamic oil. A spokesperson for Tamerlane's mosque in Cambridge, Nicole Muslim, said that Tamerlane only prayed there occasionally, yeah, like on Fridays. She portrayed him as an angry young man who latched on to Islam. No, he was raised a Muslim. He was always a Muslim. Islam is what guided his life. He said so repeatedly. It was the core of his life. It was the foundation of his life. It was the pillar of his life. He was more Muslim than he was man. But, of course, the mosque wants to say, oh, no, no, because he didn't pray here with us as often as some others pray here with us, he couldn't have been a good Muslim. As far as connecting with the Islamic community here, he actually, to actually be praying, to be involved, to doing acts of charity. Muslims view charity as committing jihad. All of those were pretty much lacking. I would say he was just a Muslim of convenience. Yes, it's convenient to be a Muslim when you want to commit acts of mass murder. You know, when Muslims try to defend Islam by disassociating Islam for terrorism, they become so disingenuous that it is amazing that any journalist would publish what they say. This journalist didn't bother to say, yeah, you know, it is. It's interesting that it's just maybe a convenience that 99.9% of terrorist acts today are committed by Muslims. I guess those Muslims must have been Muslims by convenience either, because it's more convenient to commit terrorist acts as a Muslim. Jokhar Shanaref, Tamerlane's younger brother, who has been charged with the bombings, scrawled a note shortly before his capture saying, "We Muslims are one body. You hurt one, you hurt us all. The brothers had been reading militant Islamic websites before the bombings. Friends say that the younger brother smoked copious amounts of pot and rarely prayed. So he was just reading the stuff, but it had nothing to do with his motivation, nor did his confession note. No, he was just a pothead. Tito told us, as Tito now is the next informant, that Jokar's older brother dominated him and didn't approve of his party lifestyle. He, Jokar, was intimidated, and that would probably be the best word. He was abused. There is another story that was sent to me that paints an entirely different picture. This actually has Islam from the mouth of Islamic clerics. This is the story that the BBC doesn't want to present, even though this story was developed entirely in Britain. It's called Undercover Mosque. It is a documentary program produced by an independent television company. Why? Because the BBC is only interested in lying on behalf of Islam, not exposing Islam for what it is. They would rather aid and abet the enemy and to lie about the reasons that Muslims kill than they would expose the truth. They will have nothing to do with the truth. So there was no BBC association with Undercover Mosque. So it was produced by an independent television company. It was called Hard Cash Productions for the Channel 4 series Dispatches, which was first aired on January 15th in 2007 in the UK. The documentary film footage gathered from 12 months of secret investigation into mosques throughout Britain. The film caused a furor in Britain and the world press due to the Islamic content of the released footage. West Midlands police investigated whether criminal offenses had been committed by those teaching or preaching at the mosque and other establishments. What these fellows did is they videotaped what the imams were saying. More on that in a moment. Back to Shattering Mosque. Shattering Myths. I wish we were Shattering Mosque. That would be, well, I guess we're doing that with our words. Just a moment, we'll hear what Glenn has to say about the political involvement in the Islamic world. Here's some of the statements that have been recorded. Now, 100% of what has been presented in the documentary Undercover Mosque is unedited. It's simply the teams went in with small video cameras, which recorded both video and sound, and you can see the imam saying things like the following. Dr. Ijaz Mian, on the subject of non-Muslim laws, said you cannot accept the rule of the kafir. Kafir is the derogatory term. It's like it's like using the N-word in America. The kafir is a derogatory word of speaking of non-Muslims. Yes, Muslims think that non-Muslims are ignorant. That's funny. We have to rule ourselves, and we have to rule all others. So on the subject of obeying non-Islamic laws, you cannot accept the rules of the kafir. We have to rule ourselves, and we have to rule others. Abu Usama saying of apostates, that's anyone who renounces Islam, if the imam wants you to crucify the apostate, that is, any Muslim who rejects Islam, then you should crucify him. The person who is put up on the wood, let him stay there until he bleeds to death over the course of 3 days. Abu Usama, speaking on the deficiencies of women's minds, said, Allah has created the woman. If she gets a PhD, she is still deficient. Her intellect is incomplete, deficient. She may be suffering from hormones, and that will make her emotional. She takes two witnesses of a woman to equal one witness of a man. Now, what they're not telling you here is that every single one of these statements is demonstrated to be Islamic in the Quran and Hadith. Every one of these statements was endorsed by either Allah or Muhammad or both. Now, there are many more, and we'll return to them in a moment. But I'd like to hear what Glenn has to say. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Adam. George Washington, I think, had the right idea when he cautioned against foreign entanglement. If the United States wants to be a, you know, essentially secular, pluralistic state that allows other people to, you know, express their beliefs here without infringing on the rights of others, that's fine, but it can be naive and get, you know, walked on by these other belief systems. Actually, I had specified when I called in about U.S., the folly of U.S. involvement in the Middle East, not specifically just the Muslim world or the Islamic world. We have upcoming on the congressional recess, we have 81 congressmen and senators setting off to the Khazarian Republic of Israel, the center of pornography, prostitution, and abortion from the West in the Middle East, to get their arms twisted and get wined and dined so that they can come back and push through legislation that favors that nation. And that is just as much folly as all of the involvement with Islam.
All right. Well, thank you. Glenn. Personally, I would prefer the United States to have no involvement with any country in terms of providing weapons, in terms of providing money. But to equate Israel as the advocate of all things evil in the Middle East and to put them on par with the Islamic nations is wholly and completely inappropriate. My preference would be that the United States stops sending weapons to every country, that we literally stop weapons exports. Now, I know that our country is now so engaged in the arms trade that we are the primary arms mongers of the world, that it would have a devastating short-term effect on our economy. But if we replaced arms manufacturing with energy development, then we wouldn't have that problem. But at this point, we are the merchants of death of the world, and we need to stop supplying arms to the world. Now, in the case of Israel vis-a-vis her enemies, the Islamic countries that surround her, over the last 10 years, the United States have provided 24 times more weapons, if you put a monetary value on the weapons, 24 times more weapons to Israel's foes, to the Muslims who want us dead, than we have to Israel. But if we were to recognize we're bankrupt and you cannot buy friends, you can't bribe people to like you, and we were to stop all foreign aid immediately, we would be far better off. As for America tolerating religion in our midst, boy, Glenn and I agree there. It will be our downfall because Islam will destroy us.